Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Fair shake at the sauce bottle, mate.
G'day, Mark Kenny here with the final episode of Democracy Sausage for 2023. I think it's 2023, isn't it? God, it's been a long and arduous year and one that's been not without its negative stories. But we're going to have a little bit of fun today, as we normally do at this time of year, because it is time for the fourth annual Democracy Sausage Awards. Our lawyers are preparing to defend us for a number of things that could be said here, all in jest, well, most of it anyway. We have our usual cast to do so, Dr. Maria Tafalaga from the School of Politics and International Relations. Hi there, Maria.
Hi, and I feel like we should have like some kind of music for this, you know, like a little tune or
well, that
drum
you
roll.
Have to take that up with Angus Blackman, who is, of course, producer extraordinaire, the brains behind a lot of the things we do and the muscle as well.
All-round good egg.
Yeah, we'll have to talk to him about that, yes. We need some sort of sting that really...
lowers the tone.
Yeah, that lowers, exactly. Yeah. We don't want anything raising the tone. This isn't about that. And, of course, always happy to have Professor Frank Bongiorno from the School of History at ANU and a regular on Democracy Sausage, but an absolute staple of this particular abomination.
Yeah, couldn't do this without you.
Thanks, Matt. We probably also need a trophy, like an Oscar-style trophy. I can't imagine what it would be.
Gilded sausage.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I like it.
What do you think, Angus? Do you have budget for that?
It is an audio, kind of medium that we're dealing in, though, of course.
But on the podcast, you know, there's a picture. Think about it.
On the web. Your platform's correct.
That's right. No. Like in your app, right?
Oh, right.
There's
okay.
A picture. Oh.
I see. You're thinking multi-dimensional.
That's right. That's right.
Well, I hope you can keep that up because we're going to involve ourselves in some interesting mental gymnastics now. Now, as you know, we take this very seriously, and so we begin with the August Award for the most flagrant and self-interested political backflip, a coveted award, I think, that people are, you know, hoping they can score each year, and they do their very best. I've got some names here that we can speak to, and we'll arrive at some sort of conclusion on them. The first one, Frank, over to you, is Benjamin Netanyahu on Hamas. Now, this has not been a joyous topic, the war in the Middle East. But nonetheless, speak to this. You've put this suggestion forward, Benjamin Netanyahu on Hamas.
Yes, it's a very grim topic. But yes, on this one, I mean, the things I'm hearing are that, he'd basically been, using Hamas, cultivating Hamas against the Palestinian Authority.
Yeah, the PA,
And, I was in Israel and the occupied territories in January, and we visited Gaza crossing, and thousands of Gazans come into Israel each day, and this wasn't contextualized at the time when I witnessed this, but it looks like this was a part of this kind of general cultivation, I guess, of Hamas in an attempt, I guess, to play a kind of divide and rule type approach. Here we are, basically, I suppose, is the best way of
thinking. Yeah, I suppose you could say that. I mean, the The number of people who go from Gaza into Israel now is less than used to be the case. It's probably more than was the case a year ago. I've seen some figures about this. Mm. And it used to be that vast numbers of people, because there's just vastly insufficient work and industry in Gaza for people. The unemployment rate's like about 48% or something.
Yeah, shocking.
It's horrendous.
Yeah.
And so Gaza's absolutely dependent on Israel for a lot of its staples, fuel, water, food, and other things that it can't make itself. So Israel's had a fair amount of leverage over Gaza. And I guess what you're saying is that there's been this kind of political use for Netanyahu and the ultra-nationalists that make up his government in having Hamas, who's been controlling Gaza, having them there as a kind of, the bogeyman across the border, whereas the Palestinian Authority has been depicted as, and obviously it's helped with its poor performance here, but it's been depicted as weak and illegitimate and ineffective and those sorts of things. Mm. So that's had a political advantage for, sort of a use for Netanyahu through this whole period.
It's
now it's exploded, and you can understand his backflip if that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, the other dimension of it is that by essentially facilitating Hamas being propped up largely through Qatari money, to support humanitarian assistance in Hamas over 15 years now, it actually enables the sort of dynamic where it's difficult for the Palestinians to actually coordinate as one kind of people.
Yeah.
And it also allows him to sort of say, well, how can I negotiate with these sort of terrorists, right? Which facilitates not progressing the Oslo Accords and not progressing the two-state solution. So it has been it was a very successful short to medium-term policy and one that it was inherently unstable.
Yes, and it's blown up in his face.
Absolutely,
which is not to take any culpability away from Hamas, of course, whom we condemn absolutely for the record for everything pretty well that they exist for. And in fact, it's funny. It just occurred to me when I was thinking about this earlier that right now, I haven't sort of seen this written anywhere, but right now, if Hamas was to step out of the way, there would be a greater chance, I would have thought, of Palestinian statehood than at any time in recent times. That is, there would be strong support from the international community for Palestinian statehood. The big block to that now is Hamas itself. And obviously Israel has been a massive frustrator of that goal for a long time with settlements in the West Bank and with that very strategy we've just been talking about of essentially fostering Hamas's power and limiting the PA. But, the disingenuousness and the scheming and the politics in this area has been horrendous. But it is fascinating to think that the one thing that Hamas has done is it through its atrocities on October 7 and since has been to absolutely rocket this issue back onto the center stage internationally. Mm. And I think that for all parties there would be obviously great advantage if Hamas could be got rid of without the loss of any further Palestinian lives. That doesn't seem possible, but were it possible, I think we would be on a path to Palestinian statehood, which would be a huge advance. We'll quickly go through some of the others we've got on this list. Malcolm Turnbull on The Voice. Now, this goes to the fact that Turnbull initially was opposed to the creation of The Voice.
Yeah, he called it a third chamber.
He called it a third chamber of parliament. And frankly, I think it's fair to say that there's two things to say about that. One, it was done somewhat summarily. It was almost an immediate reaction from his government at the time that the Uluru Dialogues proposed this. And another one. There was two, and that was just one of them. There was another one. The other one was just to say that it didn't exactly persist in that language, but right through recent years and into this referendum, that notion persisted. So it did quite a lot of damage, idea.
It did immense damage. And in retrospect, I mean, historians do this all the time. They sort of use hindsight and, like to sound very wise after the event. But you could, I think, make the case that it was dead basically at the point where Turnbull did that to it, because that essentially showed that someone who was regarded as of the kind of progressive wing, more progressive wing of the Liberal Party, was so beholden to his own party's right, to the National Party, that there was no room for manoeuvre on this issue, even if he'd wanted to. And that's kind of where we ended up in 2023.
It is, although Turnbull himself, of course, by then was a supporter, was a yes vote, and advocated that with some caveats, but advocated a yes vote. So that's, I suppose, why it's been put on the list.
I mean, I would have preferred if he had just been a bit more honest about the fact that he had made a mistake in his change of position.
Because he argued, in fact, that this really proved that he was a pure Republican, and that fed the argument that there was some sort of special right being conferred on First Nations people by the existence of The Voice.
Well, I think it just added additional complexity to what was already, you know, a noodle salad of crazy complexity by that stage.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, and sort of disappointing for a politician of his intellectual kind of caliber, and I suppose really sort of shone up by someone like Julian Lisa, who was so capable of articulating a case for a voice in actually very simple language, which was like linked to true facts.
Sure, yeah. But he couldn't even carry his own electorate.
No.
Julian Lisa, I mean.
Though he did get close.
He did get close. That's true. And great respect to him. We'll come back to that. Another one is Daniel Andrews, whose government bid for the Commonwealth Games and won the bid and it was going to do it regionally, which sounded cockamamie to me, given the amount of sort of infrastructure that would be involved and all of that. You could sort of understand
why
the logic of it.
Why do you hate infrastructure, Mark? Why do you hate it?
I love it. I think it's great. I think it's great. I just don't know that I like the idea of building Commonwealth Games infrastructure in Shepparton.
Narnagoon or something.
I mean.
Witchy proof.
In fact, I do like the idea of building it as long as it gets used.
Yeah,
and Melbourne is often described as the sports capital of the world, right?
Mm.
And they're quite proud of that claim. Well, I would have thought, ergo, there's some infrastructure there that might have been utilisable for this festival of the of empire. Anyway.
It's been renamed now, Mark.
The Commonwealth Games has played such an important role for this country over the decades. It showed that we were really giant killers, even though we couldn't win gold medals in the Olympics.
But we did.
Eventually, but even when we couldn't, we were still winning them in the Commonwealth Games.
Yeah, and why doesn't that gold still, Frank? Yeah.
I still cynicism.
Gold is gold, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, so there might have been chocolate inside, but that's true. That's actually quite mean to all the athletes that have won these medals. I'm really sorry. I can barely throw. So.
Besides, it'd be like saying that subsequent levels of any sport ought not bother because they're not at the top level. I mean, it still matters.
Oh, no, it's very important, not least because it's my last throw of the dice. They have lawn bowls. And let's be honest, I mean, that's the only chance that I now have playing elite sport.
I might be
a lawn bowl. Even that's becoming an issue. But
you've got the bias
the knees,
for it.
Right, so.
But I don't have the hip.
I'm going to give you a tip on it, though. I'm going to give you a tip. If you do take up lawn bowls, it's not you don't throw the dice. You roll the ball.
That's
right?
True. Yeah. That's true. my last roll of the ball. That's true. Yeah.
And another one that I thought would be worth mentioning was the Albanese government's response to the High Court decision on indefinite detention, which initially was calm and procedural, and we're waiting to see what the High Court says before we look at changing the law, because if we change the law before then, how do we know what we're patching up if we haven't seen the High Court's reasons? And then within days, the politics overcame it, and the politics basically has continued to overcome it ever since. And, of course, the government moved very quickly then and Parliament had to be established. So technically
is that a backflip or more of just sort of mad scramble to the exit?
Well, it's a backflip in the sense that it wasn't going to happen and suddenly it had to happen. It had to happen so quickly that Parliament had to stay longer and those sort of things. Perhaps not the most egregious of them. I think the one that I like most
in terms of – What we didn't actually cover was the backflip of the Daniel Andrews, with his newly repaired back as well, might add, of cancelling the games, right? You know, I mean, that was quite.
Did I not mention that?
No. We just talked about the fact that there were going to be little boondoggles out in the regional
Well,
Victoria.
Yeah, the backflip was a fact that they it was a good idea and then it wasn't.
Yeah.
Pulled the pin
on
that.
Quite the announcement, though. You know, very dramatic. Good. Yeah.
It was. Yeah. Like, it was a classic Daniel Andrews announcement, actually. If you think I'm going to waste this much money, well, I'm not.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm sorry, kids.
That's right. I'm going to spend the money on staffers instead.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he was out the door anyway. He legged it. Yeah. But yes, look,
he got 80 people in his office. Needs a few more.
It's 90, I think.
Oh, yeah. There you go. See, that bloody inflation.
It is. It's inflationary. Yeah, exactly.
And a final one. I know we're not going to get through all these if we move at this pace, but anyway, final one in this category, David Cameron. I like this one because he resigned as a result of the he was pro Remain in Europe. He resigned as a result of the Brexit referendum result. He's now back in the very same party in the very same government as its foreign minister in the House of Lords, and all is forgiven. And of course, it's massively pro leave and everything else. I just think, well,
he's got to sell it all overseas. Yeah,
those are my principles. If you don't like them, hey, I've got others.
Got some others. Yeah, it's sort of. I mean, you know, you think of Australian parallels, and there are any number of interesting possibilities. I mean, why doesn't anyone ever talk about bringing Paul Keating back, for instance? I mean,
he's younger than Biden.
Yeah, well, indeed. Still, indeed. You know, there's all these John Howard. We could get John Howard back.
Yeah,
maintain your age. Yeah. Maintain the rage.
You know, we need a House of Lords. I mean, I suppose we kind of do. The Senate's a bit similar, where parties just decide, oh, we'll bring Bob Carr in. But we can't be too smug, can we, about how they do this in Britain?
I guess the question is, why didn't Mr. Howard run for pre-selection most recently in New South Wales?
That's true.
Yeah.
And there is another critical difference, of course. I mean, he just gets appointed to the Lords.
Yeah.
I mean, there are still appointed members of the House of Lords.
Yeah.
Anyway, what do you say? I'm going to go with Daniel Andrews.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
backflips and Olympics, Commonwealth Games and stuff. It's got that athletic, connotation.
Also, you know, as disappointing as not playing the games out is, this is the one that was the least depressing and
that's true.
Actually has like levity. So I'm going to go with Daniel Andrews.
I think it's a good choice.
He's joined some salubrious company with previous winners there. So
now this one's much more serious, very weighty issues we're about to discuss here, as conveyed by the very august title, and it's a coveted one, biggest dill. In brackets, knob.
Do you remember?
It's classy in this show.
It was Laurie Oakes, wasn't it? Was it?
He loved the word dill.
Chris Barry or something. Someone, I remember he said, do you feel like a bit of a dill?
He liked the word dill. And the other word he liked a lot was dopey.
Dopey.
You know, such a policy was just plain dopey.
Dopey,
Well, I think you might have listed this one, Frank, Peter Dutton, for imagining that taking the low road on every issue will somehow allow him to do an Abbott.
No, that doesn't sound like me.
I think it's too early to say. He might be right.
He could well be.
It's true. I suppose we still are in data collection mode, aren't we?
He's
given it a red hot go, though. You know, I mean,
I think he might have pulled the wrong rein on the going hard on this Israel thing, though.
I agree there.
Because there's a lot of people in those Labor seats. We've discussed this before, but in those outer metropolitan Labor seats, safe Labor seats, that he seems to be going after, who are of Arab and Muslim descent in those communities. And the absolutely sort of completely one-sided view, this is all about absolute unqualified commitment to Israel.
Yeah.
Make no mention of civilian deaths or illegal settlements or anything like that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I guess it's part of his sort of genius, such as it is. You know, he's a very good black and white
straight lines guy
politician. Yeah, you know, and it is an interesting comparison to Abbott, who absolutely could play in black and white, but then Abbott had a large degree of complexity to him, which I think rounded out his political character and made him, I suppose, someone that people had a harder time making judgments about whilst he was opposition leader, which, you know, sort of crystallised after he became
Prime Minister. Didn't take that long for them to make judgments about him.
No, it didn't.
In fact, just by way of interesting curio on this, Abbott went from winning an election, which he won on the 7th of September in...
Second largest majority since the Second World War.
Yeah,
30 seats. Basically.
90 seats to 55. The election was on the 7th of September from memory. And by Christmas, he was back behind in the polls.
Yeah.
And that is interesting. I don't think any government... And that was partly a strategy, a deliberate strategy at the time, we were told, about, you know, trying to not be right and not be that sort of, you know, feed the media every day sort of stuff. But there was just this sort of vacuum almost. And, and then, of course, they followed it up with the... They came out of that with the March budget, which was an absolute stinker. And well, breaking all these promises and stuff. And basically it was sort of... You know, sort of don't bother peddling anymore after that.
Well, it sort of speaks to the fact that 2013 election in large part was a catharsis, and it's actually evident in the AES data as well. Yes. You know, with Abbott, I think having the lowest approval rating.
Well, Morrison, I think, won in the end
particular competition. True.
He did. One of the really interesting measures in AES was that in 1996 and 2007, on the major questions about trust, there's an increase in political trust that coincides with a change of government. There was nothing in 2013, absolutely nothing.
No, because government had been absolutely trashed. I mean, it was the whole sort of triumph of three-word slogans, as is being tried in the UK at the moment with the Stop the Boats, Rwanda plan that's now been passed through the House of Commons. On second reading, and with the help of some Australian advisors, they are going down precisely that path. And the Tories, of course, are sort of going further at it because there's even more madness that's happening there.
It's a real pity about Australia Day, though, don't you think, Mark? The fact that they're not going to have a big Australia Day celebration in Australia House in London.
Oh, really?
It's sad.
It's been canned.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's dreadful.
Yeah. Is that in the inflation again?
Oh, well, I mean,
was
it's not clear whether it's...
political correctness gone mad?
Well, exactly. It's not clear whether it's sort
it's
of...
political correctness gone mad, I'd say.
austerity or wokeness. It's just not clear at this stage. Yeah.
Well, you know...
Definitely wokeness.
One single British sausage probably costs £25, you know. can't have a proper sausage sizzle.
Well, as I saw Jeff Kitney say recently, he lived in London for, I think he said, 5 years, and he never got invited. You know, there he was, senior correspondent for The Fin, I think it was.
Yeah.
He never got invited to these things, but you had to be part of the
crowd.
Yeah, the crowd. Which is
absolutely. I think Rolf Harris used to get. He would be basically by the long experience.
Yeah, he doesn't make the list this year.
Sadly. Yeah.
Who does make the list, though, another, is Elon Musk. Now, this one's for paying $43 billion for a company that he then basically tanked, ran into the sand and turned it. I had written down on my notes, and I'm not sure whether I'm able to say this, but he seemed to have a strategy which was to make Twitter shitter.
And you know what actually is kind of incredible about his genius here is that he succeeded.
Oh yeah, he succeeded. Yeah. It's just an absolute sewer of.
Exactly. You know, it would have been better if they just when he changed the name to X and just had a little sign under new management, right? It just would have been an indication: stay the hell away from this restaurant.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why people don't just call X Twitter instead of struggling with whether saying it's X, the thing that used to be Twitter. It's X Twitter. And it certainly isn't what it was. Mm. And look, I'm going to throw another one in there, which is offshore as well, along with Musk, and that is George Santos, as they say it in America, the US Republican from New York's 3rd District, who became, I think, only the 5th member of the House in its history to be expelled, ejected, and removed. I mean, this guy has been described as a fabulist, who confected everything from his CV to his education to even his genealogy. He said at one stage that We told many people over a long period of time that he was Jewish, and then when it was established that this was entirely fictional, he said, look, well, actually what I'd always been saying is that I am Jew-ish.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And he said this with a straight face, Botox.
So that'd
to
be sort of like me being Italian-ish.
Yeah. Or Italian-ate.
But also, you know, the dad joke there about, like, Jesus.
Yeah. So it's pretty hard to go past him, to be honest.
He's sort of the John Friedrich of American politics.
Who's John Friedrich?
Oh, Maria, sorry. You're showing your youth.
Yes.
Oh, he was a fabulist in Victoria in the 1980s.
I love fabulists. I think it's always
maybe
good.
We should rename
every sort of
biggest
every
fabulist.
Sort of epoch needs one. You know,
they do. Anyway, he ran this thing called the National Safety Council of Victoria and borrowed a lot of money and eventually it went bust. And he went on the run. Yeah.
Of course he did. Of course he did.
Yeah.
The era of spivs.
Indeed.
The era of skase.
Yeah.
The chase for skase. Okay. What are we going to go with? My vote is for George Santos. I just think the egregiousness of it and the spectacularity. I've invented that word, but I think it is fine for this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I value creativity and
going hard at it.
That's right. You know,
what's this one called?
This is the deal.
Yeah.
The deal of the year. He's certainly a deal. Although he's probably gone a long way on his faking of whatever it is he fakes.
Let's move quickly on because we're gonna agree on that. So let's move quickly on to the maddest moment. Now, formally, this was just of the Trump presidency because it sort of owned the category by itself. But of course, Trump's not around. I say momentarily. He may be back.
Has he said some crazy shit in his trials? He must have said something crazy.
He's said many things.
I guess we're just all sort of inured to it, right?
There's. We've been talking a little about Israel. What about Boris Johnson and Scott Morrison going to Israel? I mean, just recently, you know, like in the wake of the attacks, to show solidarity with Israel. It's pretty mad, I would have thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was one of those things where you kind of wondered what the Israelis thought, whether they felt it was a good idea.
Oh, no, they think all such things are a good idea. Yeah. Not every Israeli. I don't want to tar them, but I'm talking about the government.
You mean the government.
I mean hard-line right-wing government.
Yeah, but two failed political leaders. I mean, it's not exactly prestige stuff, is it?
I think they'll take any,
you know.
Yeah.
Given the criticism is growing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I mean, imagine the conversation between those two. Like, you know,
my favorite for this category, and I don't know whether you two kept tabs on this, but the recent UK Tory convention in Britain, obviously, where a succession of speakers urged conservatives to fight. To get up there and fight, be prepared to fight, fight for your rights, fight to stop what's happening and so forth. This is the party of government. They've been there 13 years.
That's right.
When Rishi Sunak said that the last 30 years of government had been completely useless, of which, of course, he has been a large part of.
It was Penny Mordaunt, who was one of the aspirants for the leadership but Suella Braverman and Liz Truss, basically a cavalcade of hopefuls and pretenders and shakers downer, were
was,
all.
Was Liz Truss this year or last year? The lettuce thing was that. It feels like it was all the same year, but I think was she Prime Minister last year?
I think it might have been just toward the end of last year.
Yeah, was that a pity?
Yeah, because that
would have been perfect.
Yeah. The flogging a wet lettuce.
Not outlasting a lettuce. Exactly.
Let me just read you an extract of what she said to the Tories. This is Penny Mordaunt with her arms outstretched and pacing around the stage. It really did have the feeling of a sort of high school speech. Have courage and conviction. Because when you stand up and fight, the person beside you stands up and fights. And when our party stands up and fights, the nation stands up and fights. And when our nation stands up and fights, other nations stand up and fight.
It sounds like Bayford at the
They
MCG.
Stand up and fight for things upon which the progress of humanity depends. Freedom. That is what conservatives do, which makes me wonder what the hell they have been doing for the last 13 years. But if that struck me as pretty
Yeah, that's
mad.
Pretty bad. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a sort of unreality to that, you know. I mean, I guess the Tories in a way are desperately trying to construct an alternate
reality?
Kind of, yeah, and past in which they are the opposition running for election.
Well, this has been tried and sometimes succeeds.
Sometimes arguably succeed.
That is what Morrison did in 2019. Yeah. They sort of ran against the big manifesto of Bill Shorten Labor, ran a small target from government.
The Canberra bubble.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, I think
which he was captain. Yeah.
Well, it's true. That's true. I mean, I miss, you know, for this episode, I do miss Mr. Morrison.
He's still there.
He gave.
Hey, he won't go away.
No, I know that. But, you know, like in terms of this episode, you know, I felt he really enriched the event.
We're going to have to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to try and scoot through a few more categories.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. Let's have a look now at the most risible explanation for a government or political failure. There's a few that spring to mind here. I thought the Qantas Qatar Airways thing was pretty hopeless. Airways looking for some extra slots, as they call them. The government basically faffed around for a long time and then said no. There were already suspicions or mumblings or rumblings, whatever you want to call them, about the relationship between Qantas and the government. It didn't look good, and the government's explanation of it was incomplete, inadequate, reluctant, and in the end unconvincing, which you don't really want to be, do you? I mean, might be a description of this podcast as well, but nonetheless.
Well, perhaps, but I'll leave it to others to judge.
Yeah, that's not for us to say.
That's right. That's right. What about the government's refusal or its sort of mealy-mouthedness around the COVID inquiry and its refusal to extend the parameters of the inquiry to investigating aspects of state government decision making? You know,
is that what you think that it's about? That it's about protecting state governments from the electoral sort of opprobrium attached to lockdowns and the like?
Quite possibly. I mean, but it certainly leaves, I mean, their justification was that essentially, like, we want to keep it to federal dimensions, and the added advantage of that would be that it would focus on the previous government and not necessarily on other Labor governments. But I guess
facing elections.
Well, that's right. And when we look at the extent of the UK COVID inquiry and how important that has been for uncovering significant public policy failures, it's not like there weren't any here. I don't know. I just thought that was a mealy-mouthed excuse. Is it as bad as Qantas and Qatar? Well, perhaps not. Well, another one might literally be the backflip nomination you made around the High Court decision on detainees, you know, in terms of a failure of process, I suppose, or a justification
for
a rushing of process.
No, but I think the point you make about the COVID inquiry, the sort of narrowing of those terms of reference so that it doesn't take in everything is a pretty good point to make, actually. I mean, my first instinct about it, beyond the very factual points you make, is that I don't think there's a lot of political risk in it for the government in doing so, because people don't really want to talk about COVID. They don't want to think about it much.
Don't.
This is why we see inadequate policy now, frankly, in relation to it. And, you know, it continues on as a public health problem. And talk to the epidemiologists and first-line health workers about it, and they know this, right? And they're still wondering, where's the public relations campaign? In fact, where the hell was the public relations, public messaging campaign all the way through this? It's just mystified me all the way through.
I mean, the fact that there's no accessible public information around vaccination is extraordinary. I mean, you know, if you've had four, you're meant to have a fifth. When are you meant to have a fifth? No, I mean, you'd have to basically Google and find it buried, I imagine, a government website to find out what, you know, is the recommended way forward for this stuff. It's quite extraordinary, really. And I think a real failure of the collective will.
It is, which sort of depresses me, because one of the things I felt most sort of pleased about in the early stages of the pandemic was this notion of community that sort of seemed to suddenly come back to the fore, you know, where we were acting in ways that were not just about ourselves but about protecting each other. And I just felt like the government never really rose to that. There was always a reluctance. There was never any kind of, as I say, sort of good quality public information, you know, ads on all different platforms of the slip, slop, slap
type
level. Yeah. Because this was a clear and present danger, like right now, you know, which is essentially what present means. And yet it was all very sort of reluctant and piecemeal, and it continued that way, and it continues that way now.
It bears on... I mean, this was a great failure of the, you know, sort of Rudd-Gillard years, and, you know, I think we are getting echoes of it again. Labor seemed very reluctant to impress what you might call labor values on government, and we've seen that, you know, with, I suppose, the asylum seeker issue recently, where they basically capitulated to the opposition and its narratives and stories. And, you know, you can kind of see COVID's a great example of that, where you would imagine that a social democratic government would be talking about collective responsibility. They'd be deploying public resources so that people were encouraged to see their responsibility for the welfare of others.
Precisely. I agree. That's a very good point. And
they fail
sort of
every
where
time. I don't know why they do this. Like, I mean, it's
like the whole mask debate, for example, got really kind of mugged by this argument that I don't have to wear a mask if I don't want to. It's a question of personal freedom. Whereas it ought to have been sold much more forcefully and front-footedly as a matter of politeness, as a matter of care for that person that you are buying the coffee from, or that you are standing near on the bus, or that you are, in the near the water cooler at, or whatever it might be. That, in other words, the same reason that we cover our mouth when we cough or whatever, you wear a mask because the person that you're dealing with, that stranger you're dealing with, doesn't know whether you do or don't have COVID. You may not know yourself. And so as a matter of protection, and that was a message that I think some people got, but it never really gathered any real grip or momentum in the community.
I mean, I think it is interesting that in some ways they have not wanted to broaden the scope. Because, you know, a broader scope would involve a discussion of schools and their administration and their funding and the sort of social relation in our society, and, of course, in hospitals, which, you know, we still know are under a great deal of pressure. And I think the New South Wales government has just, like, agreed to a 25% increase for paramedic staff, you know, yesterday or this morning, in recognition of the fact that those strains are in place. And it kind of goes to attitudes that governments have had now for 30 years around the provision of public services, which relates precisely to what you were saying about labour values, you know. And perhaps one of the reasons why they might not want to go there is they don't want to deal with the inevitable recommendations that would come about a need for the state to
ongoing measures.
Yes, to step in to a greater degree, because, you know, we've run this experiment around semi-privatized care and semi-for-profit care, and we kind of know it doesn't work very well.
Yeah, we saw how it went in the aged care sector. Where it was just impossible.
It's a great Achilles heel, the sort of marketization of social services that's happened.
Yeah.
Particularly since the 90s, and you can have the most wonderful ideas coming in as a government, unless you're actually prepared to tackle that, you end up in a cul-de-sac around a whole range of areas, from childcare, aged care, educate, take your
and
pick.
And it ends up being more expensive and more dysfunctional.
Okay, well, we'll go with COVID for this category. And we'll move on to – now, this is an interesting one, actually, because as we said at the start, and I guess people say this sort of thing every year, but it feels like it actually means something this year, that it's been a pretty awful year. The war in Ukraine grinds on. There's a whole new war in the Middle East, which we've been discussing. There's Donald Trump, who is on the comeback. The right is on the rise in a whole number of places in Europe, the far right. It's been a bleak year, I think it's fair to say, and it's still affected by a range of things, and of course that we've just been talking about COVID and war related. So I think it's a hard one to pick out a dominant figure. Last year, this is most effective political leader international. I don't know whether you've got any nominations. Do you have any?
For this year?
Hmm.
Oh. It is actually quite challenging. I mean, it has been a bleak year in international leadership. I mean, I guess when I think about it, like maybe Antonio Guterres, because he's been quite...
He's been loud, but has he been effective?
Well, exactly. Do you know what I mean? I mean, last year's winner was Volodymyr Zelensky, which was just, I think we sorted that out in about 7 seconds.
And frankly, I'd be tempted to go there again.
Yeah.
Frank, do you have any...
No, I think it's been one of those years where... I don't think there has been a standout figure.
Okay, well, I'm going to throw one further one into the mix then, and this sort of comes a bit from left field, but I'll argue it a little bit. Donald Tusk is the former head of the EU. He's returned to Poland to domestic politics. He's taken on the Law and Justice Party, which has had far right party that's had a grip on a populist party that has been absolutely eroding democratic norms in Poland, and he has succeeded in achieving a vote of confidence in the Polish equivalent of the parliament, and has promised to restore democratic norms and rules and procedures, and he's a person of great standing. He's been prime minister before, I think that's a ray of light. So I'd be inclined just for the sake of saying something hopeful and having ended that awful PIS or Law and Justice Party. That's its acronym.
It's an unfortunate acronym.
It is. I'm happy to go there, again, you know, like I say, just because it's unfashionable, I don't think Zelensky's efforts at trying to keep Ukraine secure from that invasion should fall down the list either. So I'm happy with either of those.
Yeah. He would be our first Polish awardee, I believe. Have we had a Polish?
We haven't. No. We've had a German, a New Zealander, and a Ukrainian.
Yeah.
So. It's all very European, isn't it?
It is very
European. We probably do need to think in a broader scope, but
Yes, well, yeah. I mean, certainly not going to go to Argentina at the moment. You decide.
I'm happy to go with Donald Tusk for I mean, in the past, we have often actually given this to someone who's won a big election, so that's a fair point.
And it's a tough thing to do. It's always a tough thing to do, to dislodge these populists. That's their strength, you know, as they have movements, you know, as I heard old mate, someone saying it, that was my friend Jonathan Swan, who's now with the New York Times. He said that Donald Trump is the only candidate really in the race anywhere that is the head of a movement rather than just a party.
Or a cult would be another term.
Yes. He was being polite.
He's always diplomatic.
Okay, that's good. We'll go with Donald Tusk. I'll arrange to have the awards.
We'll let him know that he's back.
This will no doubt be mentioned in the I think it's called the SEM or something, SEJM. Mm-hmm. But which has excited the Polish people so much that they're all gathering around TVs and to watch proceedings in the Parliament, the Sejm. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry for those people who do speak Polish and actually know how it's pronounced. I'm sure I've got it wrong. But I saw one headline was calling it Sejmflix because they're actually putting putting it into a cinema so that people can go and watch Parliament together.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's
a moment of great relief for anyone who cares about justice and norms and the rule of law.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we need to always celebrate those moments, particularly in years like this one. What about domestically? Who do we think's been the most effective political? We'd sort of call it leader, but I think most effective political operator is a better way.
If you're going for operators, I mean,
figure. Let's not call it operator because that sounds like something for the New South Wales right.
It does a bit. Something around the lazy Susan in the Chinese restaurant. I think the role played by, you know, Price and Mundine in that, unfortunately, in my view, in that referendum was an extraordinary political operation.
Yeah.
I didn't see it coming, and this is my naivety. And
I didn't see your answer coming either, and I'm somewhat on the back foot because it's a pretty good point you make.
Well, I didn't see it coming because I assume they would be the head of an Indigenous anti-voice campaign. Mm. I just did not see it coming, and this is, again, my naivety, stupidity, take call it.
You don't want to put Gary Johns in there with them?
Yeah. Well, I didn't see that the no case would actually essentially have them as their front, their face, their public face.
Yes, and it turned out to be devastatingly effective.
It was absolutely devastating, absolutely. I mean, maybe not decisive because of the size of the yes majority, but it was certainly devastating.
Yeah. Size of the no majority.
So it may not have been the difference, but it was certainly devastating.
Yeah.
You're right. It's unknowable, but I think it is difficult to imagine the counterfactual where the vote might have been as profoundly high if you didn't have the legitimising presence of Price and Mundine fronting the no campaign.
Yeah, no, I think they account for the size of that no majority. Yeah.
Except in the ACT, of course, where they cut no ice at all.
No, nothing.
Where the 60-40 result for the no case was reversed to a 60-40 yes vote in the ACT. And I just like to say that every time because that's where we're broadcasting from.
Some quiet achievers. Chris Bowen, he has been grinding out environmental and energy legislation all year. Grinding out deals, you know?
I suppose you'd have to put in there Tony Burke as well, who's managed to get a lot of legislation through in his role as both the minister and some key legislation in relation to, you know, protecting casuals and the like, protecting employees against wage theft, these sorts of things right at the end of the year. And he's also done a good job as the manager of government business in the House. And I think the other one, and you mentioned him before, that we should put in this category as well, is Julian Lisa, because Julian Lisa was a frontbencher who resigned his position. We've had him on the podcast, of course. He's very eloquent, very calm and I think clear communicator, and he acted with principle and courage, to me that counts for just about everything.
Yeah, and when you've got something
effective in the sense that they didn't win, but that doesn't mean.
I think it was an important stand that he made, and not one that you see very often these days.
No. You do not see it enough. You
know. Well, the minister, I mean, he's a shadow minister, but ministers won't resign over anything anymore. I mean, anyone who's observed the British system would know that at least the resignation continues to play a role. You know, I remember.
And right up until yesterday, ministers actually resign over transgressions, but they also resign over policy questions.
Yeah, like, but Robin Cook over the Iraq War. I mean, really quite senior ministers.
Yeah.
But in a way, they will not hear. And Lisa, not a minister, but a shadow minister, did have something to lose and was prepared to risk it for principle, for his conscience. And I think that was whether you agree with the stand or don't is kind of irrelevant.
Yeah.
It was very admirable, I think.
Are we happy to recognise him?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's a great exercise of moral leadership.
Well, this will be a feather in his cap after a year that he worked his guts out and didn't get that result. What about Person of the Year? Now, that's one that we've given Zelensky before as well. And I think last year we gave it to Sean Turnell, Professor Sean Turnell,
We did, yes.
Yeah, and very popular it was too. Mm. And I think we also had in the mix Emmanuel Macron for saying, I don't think I know.
Was that only last year? It feels like 5 years ago.
Was that 2021?
It was 2021.
That was 2021. Right.
Yeah, it was
so
5 years
ago. So he got it for his French accent, mainly. Yeah, that's right. It turns out he wasn't faking, unlike me.
I have a left field nomination. I think the Knitting Nana group won a case against the New South Wales rather draconian protest laws. I think
yes, indeed.
You know, affirming some of our civil liberties and rights. So
stitched them up.
Exactly. Pearled them. So, you know, thank you, Knitting Nanas.
Knitting Nanas.
That's a really good one.
That's my suggestion.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Knitting Nanas.
We're going with Knitting Nanas.
This is for Person of the Year.
We can just add an S.
Is it?
Persons.
Well, okay, if we can add an S. Medical science and frontline workers. So we can have Knitting Nanas and, we, you know, and if, I think if, in the past we've given it to more than one person actually.
Okay. Well, if we're going to have multiples, I did have one written down here, which, you know, is a little more sort of, you know, kind of goes back on some ground we've already covered. But I'm thinking of the frontline health workers in Gaza. Right, the doctors, the nurses, the people who are actually saving lives, infants blown apart.
Yeah.
If nothing else, I think it needs a mention. You know, because it is kind of a hell on earth that we see. And there have now been more UN workers killed in this crisis than any other crisis they've had UN officers in. There have been more journalists killed in this war in this short period of time than any other. It is a very hyper-violent place. And there are people there, ambulance drivers, frontline health workers, first responders who are saving lives and losing their lives in some cases in the process.
Well, that's hard to argue with, Mark.
I think it's
you think it trumps the Knitting Nanas, do you?
Yeah. Yeah. It's very well put. I feel for one moment there you were going to say, you know, Carlton Football Club finally. But I'm glad it was a more serious-minded approach.
I pulled back only because we didn't make the finals.
We made the last four. And after many decades of suffering, it was pretty damn good. But no, I think that's a very good choice, actually.
Okay, we've got one last one. This is going to be Investor of the Year. I'm not sure why we're doing this last. Probably should have done Person of the Year last, but we're going to do
maybe Angus can like magically some sort of wizardry put it in somewhere a bit more.
Exactly. This is the bottom line, I suppose.
Yeah. Dun ding.
Okay. Kerry Stokes has been nominated in this for supporting the case of defamation trial of Ben Robert Smith.
Well, it's a hobby, isn't it? I collected stamps when I was younger, and that can get expensive. But it's not as expensive as this, and I don't really get it. I don't know really what it does for either Kerry Stokes or Channel 7, this stuff. But, I mean, I suppose the... It
does a lot for defamation lawyers.
It does a lot. There's a lot of defamation.
And they are
struggling.
They are really...
The inflation.
That's right. But...
one of them we've actually, who might have even been in that case, we've had on this podcast, Dr. Matt Collins. He's certainly been involved, and he's an outstanding barrister, SC.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I think it might be Casey.
Yeah, you should butter him up in case we ever need him.
We may need you, Matt.
Yeah, well, look, in this case, it would be fair to say that it wasn't, in the end, a great investment.
No, it wasn't a great investment. What about the aforementioned Elon Musk? I mean, he's not much of an investor, is he? I mean, he's obviously done pretty well for himself, the lad, but...
you have a go enough, you know.
If you have a go, you get a go.
You do.
I mean, that's what Morrison told us.
That's right. Once I haven't heard that one for years. takes you back, doesn't it?
It does, oh, doesn't it? It's like hearing a word like grouse, you know. Yeah.
It takes you back.
It's been a while.
It takes you back, but it's not so much nostalgia as triggering.
It is a bit, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know what? It's been a long time since we heard Fair Shake of the Sauce
Bottle. Sauce Bottle. Kev.
And people always say that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I do all the time. Yes. Yeah.
Well, look, that is it for our – did we decide? Sorry, we should decide.
Of those two?
Yeah, I guess it's an order of magnitude thing. But I think we should give it to local homegrown talent, you know? You know, I feel like we haven't
– Kerry, the award is on its way to you. I hope it is some solace for some money lost on
– That's right.
Causes that may not have worked out as well as you had hoped in all good faith and conscience.
Mm. Sadly not solid gold, mostly chocolate, but exactly.
Mm. Now, all that remains for me to do is to thank our producers, Angus Blackman, the executive producer of this program, who works away tirelessly and, you know, securing talent for us to talk to and the logistics and studio time and so forth, and Jack Fox, who sits in the control room and who makes us sound easy on the ear, even if some of the opinions you might disagree with. And so we give our great thanks to them and for all the other support that we get here at ANU to do this podcast. And I should say thank you also, Maria, to all of our guests that we've had through the year.
Wonderful guests. Thank you all.
All of whom come along, and we've covered a lot of really important issues, international and national, and that's been always a great pleasure to do this. And, of course, a thanks to our listeners. You are, of course, the point of all of this, the reason we do it. And we do get some very favourable feedback from listeners, and it does make it so much worthwhile to, you know, to be in there every week.
And we got
this podcast.
Quite a few suggestions for awards, which we didn't get to today, but which were genuinely hilarious.
So, yeah, that's true.
So thank you. Thank you for that.
So all I can say to you, Frank and Maria, is thanks for today. It's been fun as always, and we'll be back doing some serious and non-serious things in 2024. Got to make sure I get the numbers right.
Yeah.
It's all about the numbers in politics.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Thanks, Mark. Merry Christmas to
you. And thanks to you, Mark, for steering the ship.
Indeed.
Or the sausage.
Steering a sausage. I think you could get arrested for that.
We should have a river sausage bun race. Yeah. I don't know why I said
that. I'll put it on the list. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye.